Make sure to check us out on Letterboxd for written reviews.
For films that we've done not only on the podcast, but outside of the podcast too.
Links in the description below.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Rewatch Podcast. My name is Samuel.
And my name is Jaden.
And today we're going to be talking about Last Night in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
This is a podcast where we talk extensively about a certain film and then decide whether it deserves a rewatch from you.
You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other place that you listen to podcasts.
And if you enjoy the show, please leave a like on the YouTube video. We would love it so much.
If you'd like to reach the show, you can also leave a comment on YouTube or send us an email at theonerewatchpodcast@gmail.com.
So today we're going to be talking about Last Night in Soho, and I'm going to call it out and I'm going to quickly get up.
Where is the story overview?
The story overview is on its way.
Yes.
Give me a few seconds.
Yeah.
Here it comes.
He's getting it.
Okay. Yes. A young girl passionate about fashion design is mysteriously able to enter the 1960s where she encounters her idol, a dazzling wannabe singer.
Mm-hmm.
But 1960s London is not what it seems, and time seems to be falling apart with shady consequences.
Mm.
And just look at that poster art, man. It's just some beautiful stuff, isn't it?
It's one of my favourite posters this year.
This one here or the letterbox
one? I love the colour in this one.
Like, yeah, it's like an oil painting sort of, yeah.
I love it.
Great use of colour in this movie. So, unfortunately, this movie has not done very well at the box office. Why is that, Jaden?
I think there's just this saturation of comic book films these days that...
Those pesky comic book films.
Sound like Martin Scorsese.
Sound like Ridley Scott as well.
Yeah, look, I'm thinking that there's these movies that people are just forgetting about now. The Last Duel didn't do well either.
Yeah.
And you know, this Baby Driver is one of my favorite movies, and that did extensively well at both the box office and reception wise. This just didn't really do well on any of them. A lot of critics really hate this film as well. It's a shame, man, because I think it's unique and we need more films like this. It does a lot of stuff differently, and it probably should have done a lot of stuff a bit better. But I think overall, you know, it's a good film.
Yeah, it's definitely worth going to see.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sitting at a 3.5 on Letterboxd. Now, that's not bad by any means, but, I mean, we've certainly seen a lot worse films get into that 3.5 area.
Yep.
And so is 3.5 a fair assessment of this film, do you think?
Well, for me, no, just because I think this is the best film of this year so far. Just comparing it to other movies that are on Letterboxd, 3.5 is a bit unjustified in my opinion.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have to agree as well. I mean, it's a shame because you'd think something as original as this and something that as beautiful as this and with such a unique story and perspective and by Edgar Wright, you know, a very talented filmmaker, you think it would automatically get a free pass from the critics. I mean, the critics, they give a lot of free passes nowadays, and I feel like they didn't give a free pass to The Last Duel. They said, no, this isn't good because it disrespects women. And it's like, duh, that's the whole point.
It's a historical piece.
It's the whole point of the story, my friend. Do you think maybe this has gotten to the same sort of thing? It's like, I don't think it's really politically based. I think it's just, people just don't think it's that good.
Yeah, which is a shame. I've seen reviews from people that are massive fans of Edgar Wright, and they just think that this film just kind of flopped, that it wasn't, you know, his best work yet.
Right.
Look, it's pretty clear it's not his best work yet. And there's faults with it. We know that. Every movie has faults. Apart from certain few. But yeah, I think a lot of people just didn't enjoy this film, and I can see reasons as to why they didn't like it. But you, at certain points, you just have to look past that and appreciate this film for, you know, how unique and its cinematography and everything that it does right, which Edgar Wright has always delivered on. He's always delivered on cinematography, soundtracks, everything that makes a film, he's pretty much delivered on. You know, and then people just like nitpick at all the small little stuff and say, oh, this film's one of Edgar Wright's worst.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's, yeah, it's not his best, but it's still a really good film. Like, this dude's filmography is fantastic.
Oh, yeah, he rarely misses.
He's got some really good films.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you think this is better than Baby Driver?
No. No.
He's done the classic Australian.
Look, I have like a pretty biased relationship with
Baby
Driver.
Yeah, yeah. But this one didn't topple your... It's not your new favourite or anything.
No.
Okay.
Like, Baby Driver for me is just like so rewatchable.
Yeah,
like, I can just chuck that on and have like a good time.
Yeah.
I already know like the twist in this, so the only reason that I'll be rewatching this is for like the performances, the music.
Sure.
And like the cinematography.
Right. So I guess that sort of leads into our first sort of spoiler-free question that we always do. So we'd like to have a bit of a spoiler-free discussion. So if you have not seen the movie, don't worry, we're not going to reveal anything just yet.
Mm-hmm.
But we will tell you whether it's worth going to see. Do you think, Jaden, would you recommend this film to someone who hasn't seen it?
100%.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that this movie is pretty much appropriate for everyone. I think everyone can enjoy this movie. And I think that more people need to give it a chance. I don't think they should be relying on other people's reviews to you know, establish what they think about this film. If you enjoyed the trailers and if you enjoyed all the media that was relating to this and people said they hated it and now you're saying they hated it, well, you're a fool for that.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of this in 2021 so far, actually. I've seen the trailer for The Last Duel, thought, oh, that looks really interesting. The Guardian comes out and gives it a 2 out of 5.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, oh no, it's not good. That's a shame. Like, that deflates my excitement. But honestly, like, I keep saying, like, I don't care what the critics think.
Yeah.
But like, it does impact like how you perceive a film is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
People are saying House of Gucci isn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, that sucks, because I was really excited for that.
Yeah.
But it's so hard to just be like, nah, I'm not going to listen to that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and make my own opinion.
Yep.
But then again, if the critics tell me Eternals is crap, I'm not going to go and see Eternals.
Yeah, but I think there's a difference there, right? Like, you didn't like any of the media that was released for Eternals.
Sure.
You didn't like the trailers. You
yeah.
didn't like the marketing for it.
Mm.
Whereas you have enjoyed the marketing for the House of Gucci.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just the critics have just kind of brought down your excitement.
Mm.
You're just going to jump back
yeah.
up and see it. Hopefully.
For sure. And everyone must go to the theatre and
yeah.
make up their own mind. Because,
yeah.
I mean, even Bond, some people were saying, the new James Bond's not that good.
Yeah.
But, you know, go and have a look yourself
yeah.
and
yeah.
You know, make up your own mind. That's
yeah.
all I can say. But is this film worth a rewatch? Shane, we're yet to rewatch it, obviously, but
mm-hmm.
but are you going to go back to the cinema or are you
yeah.
perhaps...
Look, you already know that.
Yeah.
I've already said that I'm going to go back and rewatch this. I think it's such a beautiful film to just look at. The colour is fantastic,
mm-hmm.
which we'll get into down the line. But, you know, I'm cautious of whether this is going to drop. I think it might stay as it is, kind of like with how we're getting with Tenet. Like
in terms of your rating?
In terms of my rating. I've watched Tenet, like, a bunch of times now. And, like, I'm very strict with Tenet. Like, I've just kept it at the same
kept
rating
the
whole time.
What did you rate it, by the way?
A-, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. But... Yeah, I definitely want to rewatch this. I think there's so many elements in this that makes it like rewatchable.
Mm.
Yeah, it was just a really enjoyable movie.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so let's go to some acting performances, because, oh, some good performances from a lot of people in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the protagonist,
yep.
Thomasin McKenzie. My apologies if I pronounced that first name incorrectly, I should probably have. But I must admit, I have not seen her in a lot of things, only really Jojo Rabbit.
Yep.
Have you seen her in anything else? She's in The Hobbit, apparently.
Yeah, I know her in The Hobbit as well,
And did you enjoy her in that film, or...?
I hope I'm thinking about the right person. She was kind of a minor role.
Yeah, she's only in one of them.
She didn't have much. Yeah, Battle of the Five Armies. Yeah, she was... I'm pretty sure I'm thinking of the right person. I could be completely wrong. I haven't watched that film in ages.
Mm.
She's a very minor role in that, but... Anyways, jumping back to this, I think she's fantastic in this movie.
Yeah.
Just her performance is enough to carry this film on its own.
She plays Astrid, by the way.
Plays who?
Astrid. Does that help you? From The Hobbit?
You keep talking. I'm going to look up Astrid.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I really enjoyed her as the leading girl in this movie. I was... sort of more excited for Anya Taylor-Joy's performance, because she was the 1960s star, she's the glamour, and bringing, obviously they're both on the poster, so you think maybe it's going to be a 50-50 situation, and in many ways it kind of is, but I think the best performance here goes to Thomasin McKenzie. I think she was really, really good, and she's obviously still quite a young actress, so I think we're going to be seeing some really good performances in the years to come.
Sure.
And she had the range in this movie. It's kind of a horror movie at the end of the day, so you've got to do a lot of scared things. You know, when we're talking about The Night House, we're talking about Rebecca Hall's performance, how hard it is to just be like, okay, be terrified now. There's a ghost here. I know you can't see it, but just pretend. There's one right here. It's coming for you. Just be scared.
And I think a lot of people tend to forget about that.
Yeah.
You're acting with nothing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
So she was outstanding, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And we do our rewatch awards. It's coming up, really, towards the end of this year, where we take a look back on season 2 of the Rewatch podcast and give that an Oscar-like awards.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she could be in contention for best performing actress.
Yeah.
But then again, that category is heating up.
Yeah, it's doing really well. Because,
Amy Adams, Rebecca Hall.
Yeah, you've even got Florence Pugh in there.
Yeah, as well. It's going to be a tough category.
Yep.
It's going to be interesting. So what did you think of Anya Taylor-Joy in the movie as well?
I love Anya Taylor-Joy as an actress, man. I think she's doing some really incredible stuff recently, and I'm excited for some of the stuff in the future she's doing. Just her range in this was incredible, man. And I like how Anya Taylor-Joy and McKenzie share the screen, like, equally. Like, there's no one that's overshadowing the other.
Right.
And... they just kind of mesh into this one character, They kind of fit together. I think Anya Taylor-Joy was incredible in this. I think she handled all of her scenes really well. There's really no fault to it. I think she did a fantastic job.
Yeah, and Matt Smith as Jack. I mean, if you look at the material that he's given, it's not that good of a role.
Yeah.
It very easily have been a pretty cheesy character, but my goodness, he brings that menace.
Yeah.
What a performance.
Yeah, yeah.
Not
yeah.
the star of the show, but definitely did his bit for the story.
He, like, went above and beyond with what he was given.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And, I mean, what can I say? He plays a member of the royal family on The Crown. I mean, he's got good experience being, a suave monster.
You're bringing politics into it.
It's time to be a Republic Australia. No, I'm just kidding. Where am I? Moving onwards to the visuals. Oh, a big category for this section of the podcast. What did you think of the visuals and the colours and the cinematography and the effects and everything?
I'm going to say it right now. This is Edgar Wright's best looking movie.
That's fair.
Even Baby Driver wasn't that good of a looking movie. It was very grey.
Yeah. I was actually
going, what am I saying? this movie is beautiful to look at. Just like the depth of the colour, the blues, the reds, the pinks. It makes me want to watch it again, man. Like, it's a beautiful looking movie, and it's shot fantastically.
Yeah, yeah.
What are your thoughts on it while I look at the cinematography?
Yeah, so I love the use of colour in this movie, both for, like, dramatic purposes, but just for stylistic purposes and others. So, you know, you think of the room, Thomas McKenzie's room, without giving away too much, there's a big light outside, and it goes, you know, red, blue, or something like that. Yeah, and, oh, it just... The lights, the neon lighting just transports you to the 1960s. And even when it's not the 1960s, the film just looks so nice. It makes London look like an aesthetically pleasing place. And that is very difficult to do. It is not the best looking city in the world, let's say that.
Yeah.
And did you notice at the end of the film in those credits... there was just shots of London sort of intertwined with the credits.
I know you like that. I know you're a big fan of just still shots in the credits.
Yeah, there was. I love. My favorite one is when there's a rolling camera where it's just where.
Like in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, where you see him walking off and it just keeps going. You just follow him and the credits are going up. That's my favorite. But I love the creative credits. You know, I like.
I love the credits and it's how they kind of harken back to the, you know, 60s films where it's just plain white text on a black screen.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's only a few people on the one. It's not 500 people go by at one time.
Yeah. And I wanted to bring up those final shots in the end credits because Edgar Wright actually went to Soho during the lockdowns to film that because you would never get an empty Soho.
Yeah.
Not like, I don't think you can... like a production company can organise to empty that part of London.
Yeah.
I don't think it works like that.
Yeah.
It's like saying we want no one in Times Square, let's shoot it.
Yeah, okay.
It's like, no, you just make a fake Times Square. Like, you just can't do that.
Yeah.
But, like, that was really cool, just how he took advantage of you know...
The pandemic.
Yeah.
The cinematographer that has done... Well, first of all... the name is Jeong Hoon. Sounds Korean.
Yep.
I could be wrong. And he has done, or she has done, It and Zombieland, Double Tap.
I haven't seen that one. I have seen It, though. Honestly, the cinematography is pretty good in It.
Yeah,
like,
it's not bad.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think it's probably the best, most reputable movie in their filmography now.
For the cinematography.
Yeah, definitely their best work. But then again, you're working with Edgar Wright, so and he's like Snyder and Villeneuve, where it's like he's such a visual director. You know what you're gonna get when you go into an Edgar Wright movie. You're gonna get those crafty transitions and the cinematography that's just a bit extra. So it's sort of like, okay, we kind of know who's pulling the strings. The cinematographer's just making it happen.
Yep.
But still, obviously, a huge job for the cinematographer to actually make those crazy ideas that he has.
I love the transitions in this.
Yeah, very creative.
I remember leaning over to you and saying that in the cinema.
Yeah, even just at the start, you know, with that, just her on the train.
Yeah.
Just how it was like going to the music, I think.
Yep.
And he loves to sort of...
sync everything.
Yeah, edit it like a music video, you know.
Yeah, well, he's had a history with music videos.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, he's done like small budget music videos, so that's where he got to start. And there's like a shot where Thomas McKenzie like goes to sleep, the chief hall with like a cover over it.
Oh,
well.
Yeah.
There's like a big pan zoom out.
And it's this huge blanket.
Beautiful stuff, man. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, with all of the cutting in and out of, oh, it's Thomas McKenzie dancing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Anya Taylor-Joy dancing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's back to, yeah, just...
All practical, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, they, I watched a video on it. I think they call them Texas cuts or something, where it looks, it's like Kingsman.
Right. The hidden cuts.
There's actually no hidden cuts,
Right.
In Kingsman there is.
Right.
Yeah, that's my bad. But there's this one scene where Anya Taylor-Joy and Thomas McKenzie are dancing with Matt Smith, and that is all practical. There's no cuts there.
They're
dipping out of frame. They're interchanging.
That's fantastic.
Which it blows my mind how you're able to do that.
Mm.
Yeah.
You almost want to like watch that scene with like eagle vision, just try and see where like, oh, the hand's just gone out of frame.
Yeah.
That's when they're switching. But it's very hard to see that, you know.
Very, very hard.
They'll spin around very quickly and one of them goes out of sight and then the other one pops up. It's like, where'd the other one go?
Yeah, I kind of want to see like a behind the scenes of it.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be some good special features from this from this movie.
Like the scene where Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are doing the interchanging where Emma Stone's dancing and then
And the camera's going back and two, back and two. Yeah, have you seen the video where they do that?
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Like,
they're pulling the camera.
I think like someone taps them on the back.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. I love that sort of stuff. And I love when the visuals become a very important part of, you know, the story. And
yeah,
beautiful stuff. You know, I'm a sucker for some good cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of sound, it's Edgar Wright.
You can't go wrong.
So it's sort of like a better version of James Gunn. Like he's going to bring sort of a very unique sense of, you know, music and style to the soundscape. You know, all these classic songs.
Yep.
But then I also thought the score was pretty good. Like just the standard orchestral score was pretty fantastic. Yeah. What did you think?
I'm just like Edgar Wright and really, you know, all the songs he uses.
Mm-hmm.
His Baby Driver kind of introduced me to, you know, these old-fashioned songs and movies, and I'm just like such a sucker for them.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that Edgar Wright's just kind of gone like full-blown, like I'm just going to use these songs that no one knows about, just chucking them.
Yeah, right, for the 60s stuff?
Yeah, just love it.
Yeah. So Stephen Price did like the composing for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he also did the composing for Baby Driver.
Cool.
And this, and I hate what Warner Bros. Have done here with Suicide Squad 2016. Because I can't say the to describe the movie. Oh, Warner Bros.
Yeah, 2016.
Oh.
Drive 2011.
It makes me so mad. Also done like Gravity. Which I actually own. It's over there somewhere. I haven't seen it in a few years. Obviously, Last Night, so The World's End. So another. He's obviously an Edgar Wright collaborator.
Yeah, Edgar Wright's probably going on lockdown.
Yeah, and also a David Ayer collaborator as well, because he's done Fury as well. So that's two David Ayer. Also done the music for Sweet Girl, the Netflix movie.
Oh my god!
That you watched.
That's like one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Like in your life.
That was horrendously bad.
Netflix will do that to you, won't they?
Yeah.
They'll do that to you.
Yeah. Like, think of like Red Nose, but like 50 times worse.
That's difficult.
Yeah.
That's very difficult.
Yeah.
Considering Red Notice was
bad.
Terrible. Alright, so we've sort of covered on sound then. Shall we move into some more detailed thoughts?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. All right, so everyone, we're entering into spoiler territory now. So if you have not seen the film, we recommend, as per usual, that you go and see the film.
Yep.
Because this is not Black Widow or Attack of the Clones. It's actually a good movie. So go
how many movies have we like not recommended?
I think it's just those two.
It's just those two.
Yeah. From what I... Or maybe we didn't recommend The Phantom Menace.
I think that was like borderline.
Pretty borderline movie.
Yeah.
Not really, to be honest. It's more on the wrong side of the border than the right side of the border.
Yeah.
But regardless, so we can talk about spoilers in this movie now. There are a few twists that are quite crucial to your enjoyment of the movie. And because of that, I feel like maybe this is going to be sort of the best time. The best watching experience is watching it for the first time.
Uh-huh.
Do you sort of get what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
I'm
the mystery
exactly
aspect.
Right with you. You probably already know this, but I do this thing on Letterboxd called the Rewatchable Sam. And it's films that I will go back and watch again because I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
For Hot Fuzz, another Edgar Wright movie.
Right.
I didn't give it the stamp, mainly because there's a huge twist in that.
Yeah.
And once you know it, it just kind of drains everything out from it. And
it's
so that,
like mystery movie.
Yeah.
It's building.
It's a mystery movie, and it's, you know, people will say, oh, well, so does Last Night in Soho. But I will go back and watch Last Night in Soho because of the the characters, the visuals, the sound, and the colours. That's what's going to get me back into it. Hot Fuzz just had like a good cast and some good acting.
And it was quite funny.
And it was funny, but there's not much more that I would go back to.
And that's why I was sort of puzzled when a lot of people said, oh, this is Edgar Wright's worst movie. Because I've watched Shaun of the Dead, I've watched The Baby Driver and Hot Fuzz.
Yep.
And still need to watch World's End so I can complete the Cornetto trilogy. But I've enjoyed those movies, but I haven't rewatched any of them except Baby Driver. And that's only because we watched it together. Because
I made you.
Yeah, to celebrate your birthday. It's only fair, though. I did subjugate you to Tasm 2 at the end of the day.
Yes.
So it is kind of even. But yeah, I think this is one that I'm definitely going to go back to. It's it's more of sort of my style, you know, just in terms of the horror aspect. You know, I like a good psychological horror.
Yeah.
And I also just like a good drama and a good mystery. And the performances are really good.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be coming back to it.
I was so glad when you like you were sitting in the movie and in the theater and you were like, I'm really enjoying this. And
yes. It's funny because a lot of the times a movie will start and you're not particularly invested in it yet.
Yep.
It hasn't grabbed you yet.
Yeah.
But as soon as we got into the 1960s and as soon as I sort of got a glimpse of the drama of the 1960s of what was to come and how this sort of, you know, this movie's gimmick is going to work. You know,
yeah.
The 1960s traveling back in there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really into it.
Yeah.
But that start
without
the 1960s of just Thomas and Mackenzie like looking in the mirror and seeing her mum and stuff and then traveling there and then, you know, meeting her new friends, which we do have to talk about, by the way, because that character is something else.
Yeah.
And that stuff was like subpar for me. Like it wasn't fantastic.
He's always had an issue with that.
With the characters?
It's
or?
The worst part about Baby Driver. I know Baby Driver's not a perfect movie. It's like a guilty conscience of mine.
Yeah,
it's kind of like with you with Tasm 2.
Oh, I think you're in better stead, though. your film's a lot better, critically speaking.
Yeah. Maybe it should slide down to 4.5. Who knows? Yeah, I think the worst part about this is definitely the whole mother plotline and then the horror
with Thomas and Mackenzie's character.
Thomas and Mackenzie's character and her mom. They didn't really explain it all that much, and then the whole ending was very, you know, ambiguous, which is good in movies, but this one was just kind of unnecessary.
Yeah, I love an ambiguous ending, but this one just, I mean, you know, like, I was having a great time.
Yeah.
And then the movie sort of faded to black, but then came back.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God damn it. Like, that was a great ending that I just saw, and now they're still going.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this, like, the fashion show at the end.
Which is just completely unnecessary.
Yeah, yeah, not... I guess they wanted us to know that she was okay, and that, you know... But then we see Anya Taylor-Joy in the mirror, and it's like, what does that mean? I don't have enough to speculate what that means, if you know what I mean. Like, I don't have... What do you mean?
I think someone just kicked in.
What?
What if her mum... is Anya Taylor-Joy. Because her mom's dead. And it lines up. Kind of.
No, but then Anya Taylor-Joy was the lady. And the old lady in the house, remember? The big twist.
Yeah, true.
But I do see where you're going, because towards the end, we see Thomas and Mackenzie look into the mirror, see her mum.
Uh-huh.
She goes away, and then we look back into the mirror. Her mum's gone, but it's just Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah.
Or Sandy.
So maybe it's just, like, symbolising that her mum is now left in, you know, the countryside, and now that she's in London...
No, but she saw her mum in London.
Yeah, see, it's just weird. You don't need that as an ending.
You see what I mean, though? There's not enough for us to speculate from this.
Yeah.
The Night House, great ambiguous ending with Mel looking out into the boat with the shadow.
Yeah.
And from the rules that have been established in that movie, we can speculate.
Yeah.
Oh, is Mel seeing the presence?
Yeah.
Is the presence actually interacting with other people besides Rebecca Hall?
Exactly.
we can speculate because the movie's established those rules. Whereas this movie, we get the premise that she can look back into the 1960s,
yep.
but can she interact with the characters?
Mm.
Is Anya Taylor-Joy seeing her?
Mm.
Because sometimes it's hinted that Anya Taylor-Joy is looking at her.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, at the end, she blows a kiss there, so she can see her then.
Yeah.
But there's... You see what I mean? Like, there's no established
rule.
There's
not enough to go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially from the mum subplot.
And it's like, why put it in there? Because there's not going to be a follow-up to this movie. You know, Edgar Wright does solo projects, minus Babe Driver 2, which is probably going to come...
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah.
But I can't see Last Night in Soho getting a part two.
No.
Why put it in there? It just seems a bit unnecessary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can still do an ambiguous ending with it for a solo film. I mean, many great films have a bit of ambiguity towards the end. Think of Inception, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, in Inception, we've established the rules. Is he in the dream? Is he not in the dream? Because we know that he could be in either.
Yep.
So our mind goes to that question.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this, we don't even have a question to think. We're just like, what on earth is happening here?
Yeah.
Boom, it's over.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, what? Like, I can't speculate. And I'd love to speculate about what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And we almost got into it, but we just realized that there's no knowledge base there.
It's just too confusing. There's too much stuff going on.
Mm.
Like, he hasn't set it up in a way that allows the viewer to speculate.
Mm.
Yeah. Which is a shame.
Another thing we can speculate on is Thompson McKenzie's ability to see back into the past.
Because
mm-hmm. She can see back into the 1960s when she goes to that room, right?
Yep.
But then later on in the film, she can see back into the the ghosts are following her. So it's not...
It's not in that room.
It's not, yeah, it's not, you know, predominantly or only found in that room.
Yep.
But then also, like, can she interact, you know, can the 1960s be changed by her? How's the mum coming into things? Or does Thomas McKenzie just have, like, a mental illness?
Mm.
And is this just something she's seen and she's mental?
Yeah. It's just a bit weird.
So many questions.
Yeah.
Not enough answers.
Yeah, unfortunately. But yeah, that's probably the biggest issue with the film is just it leaves a lot of stuff just way too ambiguous. And then probably second to that is also some of the horror elements, which were...
Sure.
Do we want to get into that now?
Yeah, let's get into that,
Okay. So for me, the horror elements were just a bit, you know, lackluster. They just kind of kept doing the same thing over and over again.
With the ghosts. Mm.
I would have liked a lot more. Obviously, this is like Edgar Wright's first time doing a horror film. You know, it's probably expected that he's not going to be amazing at it.
Yeah, sure.
He's more of a comedy sort of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the horror was just... It wasn't really scary. The scariest part was, and I'm kind of paraphrasing from what you said here, is the kind of unknown. You know, you don't want to go back to the bedroom
right.
because you know bad stuff happens there. So the scariest part was essentially nighttime in that room. Which is really good. I think they utilized that fantastically.
Yeah.
But everything else was just kind of generic, boring stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I was going to change the microphone. Yeah. So I was often like, we spoke about this in The Night House where horror movies will sort of have like, they'll have like a horror session or a nighttime session. And so it goes dark.
Mm-hmm.
We get our horror stuff, and then it's daytime, so you know, you can relax for a bit, because there's not going to be any horror elements here.
Mm.
And in this film, I was sort of dreading her going back to the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
when, once we were sort of, you know, learning about the more sinister side of things. But, however, I did enjoy the drama in the 1960s more than the horror stemming from the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed Anya Taylor-Joy's story and like just how, you know, brutal that was and
mm-hmm.
just like the environment that she had to live in
mm-hmm.
from her perspective.
mm-hmm. was really interesting, and not we haven't really seen a lot of films do that before.
Exactly.
So I enjoyed that more than the horror elements.
Same. Same here. I think Anya Taylor-Joy probably had a stronger character development story than Thomas and Mackenzie.
Sure.
Yeah, which is a shame because I think the main character here was Thomas and Mackenzie. I think she was the lead
yeah.
in this movie. But that's not to say she wasn't bad. She was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Anya Taylor-Joy's like character development and then the whole twist and everything, which we called, were geniuses.
Yes. Well, you called that, I think. You called that prematurely before.
And then you said something else. I don't remember what you said.
We do have to acknowledge, though, that the trailer got us. The
yeah.
trailer fooled us.
Yeah.
And the trailer sort of makes it seem like that old white guy at the bar is Jack.
Yeah.
And that's what we think for about half of the movie, I'd
yep.
say, or maybe more than half.
Mm-hmm.
That he's a CEO guy. He must be Jack. He must have killed Sandy and all of that. So we see him as like the villain, and then there's like the twist that he's actually the good guy that we've seen in the 1960s.
Police officer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I think, why was he acting so seedy all the time? Like, why
yeah.
was he in the bar going, oh, I've done a lot of things, girly, you're going to have
yeah.
to be more specific. And why was he, like, acting all like a, almost like a sexual predator?
It's London,
sort of,
bro.
Yeah, just like, he was, like, looking at her too long.
Yeah,
it's
a bit weird, eh?
Yeah. So they definitely made us believe that that was Jack. Like, everyone, even the performance,
mm-hmm.
was, like, essentially pretending to be Jack.
Yep.
So then I sort of found it cheap when I'm like, oh, that's not the police officer. The police officer is a nice guy, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe his life took a certain turn, but
who knows?
Either way, I sort of see the movie in the character, you know, purpose that he's playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to fool us.
I still really like the fundamental story that they've got going on.
Mm.
I think the story's really strong. Just the whole fact that there's this sort of murder scene where you know, Thomas and Mackenzie can see the murderer and the suspect and the killer.
Yeah.
And then she has to kind of
investigate
it and, you know, try to convince the police that she's not insane. And then you've got like a tying back into like modern day reality where you're not really safe in both parts of it.
Right, sure, because the killer is supposedly on the loose
yeah.
in the modern day.
Yeah, which is cool. So I think the fundamental story here is really good, and it picks up in the third act, like, dramatically. When you start to realize, we're in spoiler territory now, when you start to realize that Sandy is actually the hotel owner.
Yeah.
Which is such a good twist, man. Like, I didn't see that coming until, like, minutes
before. Yeah, minutes before it was revealed.
Yeah, I was like, okay, yeah, she's got something to do with this. Which was just fantastically done. Like, it was just so, like, uneventful. Like, I didn't see it happening, and then, bam, like, got you.
It's like a hidden character. It's like, you know, people make fun of the Scooby-Doo episodes because it's like, oh, who's the villain? Well, what characters have we seen in this episode? It's got to be one of them.
It's got to be the least suspecting one.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But, yeah, in this, like, I genuinely just didn't expect it until you sort of raised the suspicion. And then we did kind of call it before we saw the letter of Cassandra or whatever her Sandy is short for.
Alexandra.
Yeah. So that was kind of cool, but then again it still got us for most of the movie and it still served as like a meaningful twist to oh, right. But then I think more of the twist is the fact that because she's still alive, what happened to all of these like terrible men that supposedly, like, you know, did lots of bad stuff to her that I can't say because of, you know, the old YouTube algorithm.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that was more of a twist for me, learning, oh, where are all these guys?
Yeah. And it's essentially like you just, like, kept them under her floorboards.
Just murdered them all. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what was really interesting was, and I appreciated this, the fact that the movie didn't really take a side of what was right and wrong. It just sort of showed what was happening.
Yeah.
You know, there was no, like, feminist, I'm going to kill all these males, look how strong, and I'm taking charge.
Yeah.
But then again, in the reverse of that, there was no like, oh, these poor men, all they tried to do was
like,
sexually assault her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so
it just kind of played the middle ground, like the,
exactly.
The devil's advocate, just kind of sitting
for
in the
both,
devil.
Yeah, because
yeah.
they're both parties, obviously. I mean, one's a murderer, and then one's, you know, trying to do other.
Yeah, they just let the story
things.
Happen as it
yeah.
should.
Yeah.
There's a really good scene where Thomasin McKenzie is kind of climbing the staircase, like he's sort of going back up it, and it's like switching between this like effervescent sort of colourful staircase. I don't know if you remember it.
Right.
But like it's this beautiful staircase.
Oh, when she's being chased by
yeah,
up
yeah,
the stairs.
Up the stairs.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
It's so beautiful looking, man. Like that shot.
The cutting in between the
yeah.
old lady and Anya Taylor-Joy. I'm like, just give me Anya Taylor-Joy. Much easier to look at. Much easier to look at.
Yeah.
Much rather watch that.
That was a beautiful sequence. I love that whole part.
Mm.
Where she's kind of climbing the staircase and then she goes back into the hotel room and then all of the men just kind of like pile on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, we end up hearing that they're actually saying, help us.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, she's kind of piecing it all together. She's like, hold up.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think that whole final sequence is probably like the best part of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. This brings me to a completely separate topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this in the movie. I mentioned this after the movie.
Yeah.
But there is a certain portrayal of a particular character in this movie that I just found to be one of the most realistic performances portrayals of any female teenager I have ever seen in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Jocasta, I think.
Jocasta, yeah, whatever
yeah.
it was.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It was just a very posh, like, weird name.
Yeah.
Like an extra name.
Yeah.
You know, not many people have.
Mm-hmm.
And the performance there is fantastic.
It's
like,
so good.
Like, such a, you know.
She nails it.
Yeah, she just infuriates you.
Yeah.
Like, just the way that she... she couldn't have the attention on anyone else. It always had to be on her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Thomasin McKenzie reveals that her mum killed herself. And then Jocasta goes, oh, my uncle killed himself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was really sad for me too.
Yeah.
And that line on the page probably looks really cheesy.
Yeah, yeah.
And like a rom-coms, like
uh-huh.
a 17-year-old like high school movie or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah,
like
I was going to say that,
yeah.
yeah.
But it's delivered with such, like, I just feel like I've known people like this.
Yeah, it's such an underrated performance.
Yeah,
you're definitely right.
Yeah.
And it could so easily be like, oh, it's just teenage drama.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is a person who wants all the attention.
Mm.
But that actress plays it with, like, such class.
Yeah.
Like, she
yeah.
does such a fantastic job at just
yeah.
being despisable.
Yeah,
like you just hate her
absolute B-word, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
just that is the perfect representation. Like,
yeah.
I could not have done it any better.
Yeah.
Like, if I was voting for the Oscars, I would vote for her for supporting actors. Just because, like, why not? Like,
yeah,
why?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah, it's a perfect performance.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
fantastic. And I just remember seeing the character, like, whenever she came up, I just became infuriated. And so were you.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I'm supposed to feel.
Yeah.
And it's not like a, oh, here we go, here she comes. It's, oh, no, I'm physically, like, I despise this teenager.
I kept laughing when I saw her, because I was
yeah.
like, oh, we're going to get some good
yeah.
stuff going on.
Yeah,
yeah.
And just the way that she's like a modern-day bully. Like, that's a very good representation
yeah.
of a
yeah.
modern-day bully. Just like,
but, like, not even a modern-day bully, you know, like, we've seen the modern day bully.
Yeah.
She's like more than the modern
That's
day
like
bully.
The psychological, like,
yeah.
Just shut up. Like, you just
yeah.
want to just tell her. Just like, not everything is about you.
Yeah.
Just be quiet. Like,
yeah.
let somebody else have the airtime for a minute, you know.
Mm.
But I had to mention that because it was honestly one of the best things about the movie. Just how realistic that was. And just for, like, just how realistic the entire movie is, just to England.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Wright's really good at this. And British films, I mean, you look at the James Bond movies and there's just something about, like, filming in England that's
yeah.
just, like, it's more interesting than filming in America. Like,
yeah.
sorry to the Americans, I know, like, 30% of our audience are American, but,
yeah.
but, like, it's just something that we don't see often, you know, or see less often than, you know, just being in Los Angeles or California,
yeah.
New York or whatever. And just Edgar Wright always really nails the British aesthetic. You always have like the British police officers and the taxis and all these British sort of icons. So.
And I think the reason he does so well with, you know, British people and characters and stuff is he's got like a history with it. Hot Fuzz was actually filmed in his hometown. Like he used to walk those streets as a child to school and stuff. So yeah, he knows like the location and the people, so he can establish those characters and build upon them. So yeah, he's got like a history with it, which is why it comes across so natural. Gicosta is probably based on someone that you.
It certainly seems that way. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've met people like that.
What do we think about
The boyfriend?
I think it's John. It could be completely wrong there.
Not good. That is more of like a the teenage 17-year-old drama movie character.
Yeah.
And I just feel like his one job was just to be the beacon of light for Thompson McKenzie's character. Just the one person that's just like, it's going to be okay, I'm going to help you. Like, what can I do? Like, major simp. Major simp.
Yep.
Simp alarms going off. Michael Zowski got nothing on this guy. Wally comes close. This guy, he may take... Do we have a category for the biggest simp on the Rewatch podcast?
I don't know, but we should.
I think we might.
Yeah.
If we do, clear winner.
Clear winner.
It takes the cake. Yeah. I mean... But there was something unrealistic about the character. Like, what did you think?
I don't know. It just kind of felt lacking in depth. Should have been more fleshed out. I think the actor has like loads of potential. I think he's a great actor. I don't know. He was a big part of the story, but at the same time, he just wasn't really given enough to be interesting.
Sure.
I don't know. It was just kind of. A lot. I expected a lot more of it.
It was sort of like, you know, you can draw comparisons to some of the Baby Driver supporting characters. They sort of seem like they're just caricatures. They're sort of just like, oh, you're a tough guy and you're, you know, sexy lady. And
Well, you're not wrong.
And in this, it's sort of just like, you're positive, wholesome boyfriend. You do no wrong.
Edgar Wright's got a problem. I think that's his main issue. It's just like he focuses on certain characters a lot and then he just forgets about certain characters.
So I'm like, you know, Zack Snyder, he needs a writing buddy. You know, he needs somebody to.
That's the problem. Simon Pegg does a lot of writing for Edgar Wright. And he's worked on all of the Cornetto trilogy films, which are like fantastic characters in them. He hasn't done Baby Driver and Last Night in Soho, which is...
Well, that makes sense. Like, Baby Driver and Last Night in Soho aren't comedies. Like, I imagine Simon Pegg, like, comedies, that's his thing. Like, he knows that comedic timing and the comedic performance. I'm sure he did get writing help for this movie. I'm sure that the writer's credited. But, I don't know. We just need more depth in those other characters, and that would really help it on the rewatches. You know, because I do fear that this will deteriorate on several rewatches. Maybe, you know, the second time you watch this, you think it's just as good.
Yeah.
But then maybe the third, fourth, fifth time.
You start to realize that the characters aren't as good.
Yeah.
It's exactly with me with Baby Driver, man. Like, at the start, I was like, okay, this film's like perfect.
Yeah.
Like, I love this film. And then, you know, further down the line, I'm like, some of those characters are just a bit useless. Like, what's the point of them?
All right, well, do we have any other thoughts that we can gather about this movie?
I think touched bases on pretty much everything.
Say the production design deserves to win awards.
Yes.
And costume design deserves to win awards.
Yes.
If I don't see this movie at the Oscars,
like, something's wrong.
I already don't care about the Oscars.
Yeah.
But, like, I care less. I see so many reviewers. They're like, if this doesn't happen, I will lose faith in the Oscars.
Yeah.
And that thing never happens. Like, so they should theoretically lose faith in the Oscars every year. But they keep going back.
Exactly, yeah.
So, but, I mean, this, I think, Thomasin McKenzie, probably best actress.
Yeah.
If Anya Taylor-Joy counts as a supporting,
100%,
I think supporting, Costume design, easy, boom.
Oh, 100%.
Check that in with the Last Jewel costume design nominations there.
Yep.
Cinematography, easy, put that in.
Production design is a good one for the race as well. Like the fact that they could recreate 1961 is just incredible.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just the feel of it.
Yeah.
It was so convincing. And I just wanted to be there until, you know, the darker side would start to show itself.
Yeah.
I had such a fun time in that environment, and I almost, you know, it kind of gives me hope that a James Bond film could go back to the, you know, that sort of time period, you know.
Yeah,
fingers crossed, that's what they do. But, yeah, I mean, it has very, very good separate parts. But the finished product is lacking in some areas, and unfortunately that holds it back. However, we still came out of the movie, and we were like, this is like a fantastic movie, and one of the best of the year, and we're probably going to go see it again. So, it's been a pretty subpar year, if I do say so. Like, unfortunately, while we have had a lot more, like, releases compared to last year, I mean, think what came out in 2020, essentially Tenet and nothing. Like
Tenet and The Gentleman, like, that's it.
Yeah, right. And so we've had more movies, but I'd say only three or four have been exceptional. And this one might just get in there.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe third on my list at the moment, maybe fourth. I think it might be TTB. But yeah, it's pretty high on your 21 list as well.
It's top for me. It might end up going down. It's very close to Tommy the Last Fuel and this, but I think. Quiet Place Part 2 is also very high up there. They're pretty much like interchangeable. I just need to watch all of them again to see where they sit.
Of course, All right, going on to the music segment. So every podcast we do, we like to point out the music in films because, as you probably noticed from this podcast, we place a lot of emphasis on the music of films. And, you know, when it's not there, we're sad.
Yeah.
We're depressed.
Yeah.
We feel that in our souls.
Yeah,
we love a good soundtrack.
Mm.
And does this movie have a good soundtrack, Jamie?
Of course. I mean, it's Edgar Wright. If it's Edgar Wright, he's got a good soundtrack.
Yeah.
You don't need to
look
into it.
And you can expect that from Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
However, what I did not expect was Anya Taylor-Joy singing.
Yeah.
These actors, they just do this. They just sing, and they're just good. I mean, I don't know how they do it.
I'm going to pick you up here. It's Anya.
Anya. I'm pretty sure it's Anya.
I've seen an interview
where the I don't know. I'm 50-50.
It's Anya.
Anya.
It's Anya. Trust me on this.
I'm gonna look up this interview as soon as we're done the podcast.
Well, that's all good because I know I'm right. Anyways. All right. Yeah.
Say the name.
Anya Taylor-Joy. Yes. Robert Pattinson.
but that's how you say Robert Pattinson's name.
Robert Pattinson. Okay. Anyways, Downtown, you didn't expect her to sing, right? And I think she did such a great job.
Mm.
I haven't heard her sing before, and I think this was great.
Yeah. This role, I mean, obviously Queen's Gambit was exceptional, and she did a great job there. And that sort of brought her into the sort of, you know, the news cycle. People started to notice her.
Mm-hmm.
And
and now we've got her playing Princess Peach, right?
Oh.
In Mario movie.
I mean, look, that's hardly going to accelerate her career. But this, I mean, Princess Peach, that's a paycheck. But this is accelerating her career. This role here. It's a big budget movie, and it's a well-known movie, and hopefully we get some Academy recognition. We also have Starstruck by The Kinks. That's a classic song, right? And do we believe that... How has that worked into the movie? That wasn't the Borrow song, was it? That was...
I think it's the song where Thomas and Mackenzie's character is like first going into London.
Yeah, she's got the phones on.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
Pretty much the whole soundtrack is amazing. We might end up switching out some of these songs to other ones. These are just like quick ones that we liked at that point in time.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to deny the singing capability from the lead actress there. So.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, so with that The music segment, those two songs go into the rewatch playlist, which is a playlist on Spotify. There is a link in the YouTube description, or if you're on Spotify, you can just search the rewatch playlist and it will come up. And there's a maximum of two or a minimum of one song from every movie we've ever done on the podcast in that playlist. So it's a pretty big playlist nowadays, and some bangers on there. So when you're going for a drive, just chat on the playlist and have a good time. There's some great songs from Trek 2 to Trek 1.
Yeah.
All the classics.
All you could ever need.
That's all you could ever want. So yeah, with that, shall we go to some final thoughts?
Let's do it.
Okay, do you want to go first or shall I?
I'll go first.
You talk about this film, it's pretty clear that they're fault in it, right? I said this at the start, no movie is flawless, there's always going to be issues with it. And there's a handful of faults here, but I think at the same time, also, this movie does a lot of things that just blew me out of the water.
Sure.
You know, we've talked about the acting, which is just phenomenal by pretty much everyone in this.
Yeah.
The characters are lacking at certain times, which I think could have been easily fixed if Simon Pegg was involved in this project. The visuals are probably the best part about this. It's just a stunning movie to look at. It's one of the best I've seen for quite some time. So if you're a big sucker for visuals, go check it out. You'll enjoy this movie just on that. The sound design, as we just touched on, it's pretty much flawless. Edgar Wright has just, he's got such like a big like discography just in his mind that he's just able to channel all these songs into whatever project he likes. So just fantastic there as well. Obviously some of the horror elements are a bit at times, but at other times they were really good. So it just kind of balances out there. But as I stated on my review for this, I think it pretty much gave me everything I wanted from this movie, and at certain times it accelerated that as well. And for that, I'll give it an A-. I'll just stick it where it is now, and why it ended up going up or down.
Cool. I really appreciated the uniqueness of this film, and unfortunately, I think it's why I know a lot of people went to see it, because there's not a really big market for unique films nowadays, which is really, really quite sad.
Yeah.
But it's not millennials' fault, really, Scott. It's not because we are on our phones. It's because your marketing was crap. So that's why we didn't go to see The Last Duel. I mean, of course we did, but you know, what can I say? Nobody else did. And not a lot of people went to see this, which is a shame because it's quite good. And there are certain aspects, as you've said, that I think are exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly enjoyed the performances from pretty much everyone involved.
Yeah.
And Edgar Wright, I mean, he's always going to be a director that has a unique style and is going to be interesting to watch. And the best directors, they have their own style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Denis Villeneuve, Christopher Nolan, Zack Snyder, you know what you're going to get when you watch these movies.
Yeah.
And that's more exciting than going to watch a movie directed by John Watts. What's John Watts' style?
There
is no style, right? And so I love seeing directing done with a unique lens.
I think you can tell where there's like a genuine passion for someone that's directing a project. John Watts, he's probably got a background in directing.
John Watts is probably a very talented filmmaker. He's just in the wrong, like he's got the wrong boss. Let's just say that.
That's the same that goes for Rian Johnson. He absolutely stuffed it with The Last Jedi, but Knives Out is amazing.
Yeah, it's a
great film. So I think it just depends on the project that you were given. You can genuinely care about a project and you can genuinely just not give something about a project. So I think John Watts is just stuck in the wrong box there.
Sure.
But Edgar Wright making his own stuff, he's got 100% creative freedom. He can do whatever he wants.
Exactly.
And that's why his films are consistently good.
Yeah.
Because he enjoys what he's doing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I think I'm going to go on a B+ for this one, because I mean, I gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd, which is the same as you, I think.
Yep.
So I'll just edge on the side of caution for now, because usually I don't do that, so I'll do that this time.
Mm-hmm.
But I am looking forward to rewatching this movie, whether that's going to be in the cinema or when it comes out on 4K.
Mm-hmm.
remains to be seen. I guess it depends how much time I have in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, I really enjoyed the film, and I came out of the cinema very impressed, and you know, it was a great experience. So, and it is very high in my 2021 list at the end of the day. So it's a great film, and I'd recommend it to a lot of people, especially like British people, because it's a great British movie, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's not a lot of those out there nowadays, you know. So it's it was good stuff, and I enjoyed it. And unfortunately, there isn't that discussion to be had about the ambiguities, but we were still able to chat about a lot of the really good things about the movie, so that was good.
Go and watch it. Deserves more publicity.
It certainly does. So we'll leave that there for now. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Rewatch Podcast. If you'd like to follow us on Instagram, you can do so at the Rewatch Pod.
And if you'd like to subscribe to the YouTube channel, just search the Rewatch on YouTube.
And next episode, we're doing Mamma Mia. And
come on, man. How long is it joke going to go on for?
Doing Shrek the Third.
No, we're not. No, certainly not.
Okay, we'll meet in the middle and do Shrek for a while.
We'll meet in the middle and do Mamma Mia. How about that? Also, like, we just crossed 300 subscribers, which is pretty cool. I mean, it's very nice to see people subscribe, because it means they've like watched a video and they want to come back for another video. So that's really cool. So thank you for subscribing, and thanks for commenting on all of those videos. It's been really cool to interact with people and you know, have a discussion about the videos that we've done, and it's really cool and just to know that people are liking the content and generating discussions about that, because that's what, you know, we do here. We discuss things that we like, and whether you didn't like what we said or you did like what we said, we're happy to have a discussion about it, because that's the fun. That's the fun part, you know. So with that said, thank you for listening, and bye for now.
See ya.